Welcome to Success Is Podcast. I'm your host, Phil Portman, serial entrepreneur, author, and podcast host. Whether success for you is more money, time with your family, a healthy, well-balanced life, or freedom, I'm interviewing guests and getting you the advice to make it happen. So join me as we uncomplicate the complicated, help you define success, and give you the strategies to make it happen. Hello, and thank you for joining me today with the Success Is Podcast. I'm your host, Phil Portman. Today, my guest speaker will be Mike Conrad. He's an entrepreneur, business owner, speaker, podcast producer, and podcast host. Thank you for joining us today, Mike.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. So let's start with the first question I have for you is, what does success mean to you, Mike?
Well, I'm going to split myself in two. There's going to be two Mikes to answer that question. Mike number one would be how I would have answered that when I first started my business. And then Mike number two will be how I answer it today, because it's two different answers to the same question. Is that fair?
Fair.
All right. So old Mike would have said success is lots of income, lots of money in the bank, a sexy car in the driveway, driveway connected to a big house, and all my friends think I'm cool. That would be the monikers of success 30 years ago. Today, success is freedom, happiness, being able to do what I love rather than what I have to do, and being able to, in some small way, but meaningful way, change the world, make the world a better place. To me, that is success. And if money's there, great. If money's not there, great. And I don't know how sincere I am about that statement, but fundamentally, I believe that. The definition of success morphs the older, the more experienced, and hopefully the wiser one gets, at least in my case.
Absolutely. No, it's great. Great answer. And I look at that the same way. I want to leave the world a better place behind than when I entered it, right?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. That's the goal.
So you mentioned a time where you had come to the realization that the mindset required to start up a company is quite different from the one needed to keep the business going years later. Can you elaborate a little on that and give me an example of the new skills you needed to learn to keep the business going strong? And how did you come up with this realization?
The hard way. I'm writing a book about what not to do in business. I've read a lot of business books about, you know, this is what you do to do it right. Mine is completely the opposite. These are all the mistakes I've made. Don't follow in my footsteps. Just avoid where I stepped and you'll be fine. In my case anyway, and I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs and I think I wasn't alone. The skills required to start a business from scratch, from nothing, out of your garage, like I did, are arrogance, ego, a very poor assessment of risk, passion, guts, luck, money. And usually you don't have all those. Usually the last one, money, is missing. Because 75%, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, 75% of all new businesses are gone in 10 years, 50% in 5 years, I think 30% in three. And those are terrible odds. If those were the odds of a roulette game in Las Vegas, I would not sit down at that table. No one would. You know, at least the worst odds in Vegas are 50-50. You know, now you can get some 35-to-1 odds, you know, if you're playing the inside of the roulette table, 50-50, almost 50-50 if you're outside of the table. But imagine a 75% chance of losing your investment. And if you did win, you win like 10% if you're lucky. You know, all entrepreneurs are on their first year in business, particularly if they can get a 10%, you know, net profit margin, they're celebrating. Their drinks are on them. And they've just had a 75% chance of failure statistically for a chance to win a 10% return, if that. And those are horrible odds. So you have to be a little foolish and a little bit crazy, full of, as I used to say when I was younger, you know, piss and vinegar. You just need to just be that bull in the china shop, not accept the risk, think it doesn't apply to me, and be a little nuts to do it. Now, that attitude is what gets you going. That attitude starts you out of the gate. I liken it to the gears in a manual transmission. For those listeners of yours that are maybe a little bit older and remember what it was like to go through the gears of a manual transmission, you know, you start in first, but you can't go far in first. First is highly leveraged. You know, you're redlining your tachometer, you know, at 30 miles an hour in first gear, but you can't start in fifth. There's no way, you'll burn the clutch out. So you need to use a highly leveraged gear, like first gear. And to me, those are the skills. Those are the first gear skills that I mentioned, the luck and arrogance and ego and naivety and all of those things. But that won't, just like first gear, won't get you too far off the start line. Neither will those skills. Those skills have to be shifted to the next set of skills, second gear. And maybe you drop a little bit of ego, you drop a little bit of naivety, you start to get a little savvier, you know, as you get more experience, you start to go, I won't do that again. And you learn from it. And then eventually you go into third, fourth, fifth, however many gears this analogy has, and you get wiser and you get savvier and you know how to play the game better. And I think that's the reason why 75% of businesses fail. I don't think the businesses themselves are flawed. Some are probably, but I think that this 75% of businesses that fail, probably 75% of those businesses had founders that only had one or two or three gears. And, you know, the speed at which you fail is probably the inability to shift from first to second. You know, you're going to fail fast if you can't go to second. You're going to fail a little later if you can't go to third. So, and then those that make it were able, either had all those skills or more likely acquired those skills just before they needed to shift. I think there's a lot of similarities between a transmission and the skill sets that are required to run a business. I also think it's important I think that those skills come to you, the realization that you don't know what you don't know comes to you at exactly the right time. Not too soon and not too late. Just think about it. If the skills came too soon, if all of a sudden, when I was about to start my business or 2 days into it, I lost my ego, I lost my naivety, I lost my passion, I started being quite risk averse, I would give up. I would just, what did I just do? And I'd run away. So I think acquiring the skills at the right time is really important. Not too soon, certainly not too late.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you. And you had a few points I want to talk about on that from there. The first one being high risk and often low reward. I found that people that get into entrepreneurship strictly for the money usually don't find success or are not in it for really a long time. That there needs to be a bigger purpose to what you described, and so I'd like to hear your feelings on that. Right, so determining, is entrepreneurship something that's right for me? Right, how would I determine that from a business standpoint? And have you found the same thing? People that are chasing it for money alone are typically not finding the success to sustain them through that.
Yeah, this is not going to make sense, but I'll try and make it make sense. The first statement won't make sense. Money is something most people can't afford. Now, what does that mean? You know, how can I not afford money? I was really good at bringing in money to my business when we needed it. And we needed it all the time. The first 6 weeks we were in business, we got sued by my former employer and a competitor, and we ended up going to trial. They lost, but we all lost. You know, it sucked up only 100% of my operating capital within the first few months, so I got really good at getting short-term money in. And the problem with getting short-term money in, when that's all you're thinking about, is covering payroll next week, or you know, whatever you need the money for, buying parts, you'll get that money. That's not hard to get. It won't be profitable money. It will be losing money. So we want money, we bring in money, but it's not enough to cover everything. It's just enough to cover the emergency. You know, so we took all the water that we had and we put out the fire. Now we have no more water to drink. You know, it's that type of thing. So what I've learned over the many, many years, and I'm not the only one to learn this. This is a very common experience. When I speak to entrepreneurs on my show, I hear this all the time, that if you chase money, you will not be successful. Money is the result of your business actions, not the goal of your business actions. Now, obviously you need money to pay the rent. You need money to, you know, make the world go round. I'm not naive, but if that is your primary goal, you know, stick with your day job and maybe play the lottery, go to Vegas, whatever you want to do. I mean, people do win. But the moment we took money off the table as a primary goal, the moment we said, look, what's the right decision? Take money off the table. What's the right decision? If we had all the money in the world, what would we do? We started making decisions like that. And the money came. It was kind of voodoo-y, you know? It was kind of very strange, but not really. Now that I look back on it, I can see the causality of it. But at the time, it was like spooky. Like came in right when we needed it, you know, just like in a Hollywood movie. But when we took money off as our goal site and we just said, look, let's just build the best products in the world and let's choose our customers wisely and let's make savvy business decisions and let's concentrate on profit, not cash. Let's make sure that we're providing value to our customers and receiving the appropriate value back. Let's change our pricing to value-based pricing rather than cost-based pricing. Let's just take the old models and throw them away and start developing new models. And ironically, money came when we needed it. Sometimes at the very last minute, because I don't know, the universe likes its drama, but it always came in. And I think the way the world works, and this is going to sound a little wacky, but I'm from California, so you can just, you know, write me off in that term. I think that if you do the right thing, if you treat people well, if you put the proper energy in the right places, you get abundance out of that. That abundance might be money, that abundance might be happiness, that abundance might be a number of different things, but depending on what you're looking for. But it works. And we didn't realize that until we ran out of money. And I think when you're ready to learn something, sometimes you need a blank slate. Sometimes I call it the sales gods. I don't mean that in a religious sense at all, but I call it the sales gods. When the sales gods want to teach you a new trick, there's no room for old information. You need to be wiped clean in order to rebuild. So sometimes that means you got to lose everything so that you can replace that with something more sound. And so, you know, we always had our best experiences very shortly after our worst ones. And just when we thought we were cocky and we had the world by the horns, so to speak, you know, we would have a terrorist attack on September 11th, and that would upset our industry. And then just when we got over that, we would have the largest financial collapse since the Great Depression, 2008, which upset our industry, the electronic manufacturing industry. And then just when, you know, we get over that, you know, we lose our line of credit, the banks call our loans, we somehow don't fail, we keep going. We build stronger than we were before, and we have a global pandemic that shuts down the economies of the world. And you just keep going back to what you do. That never changes. The rules of the fundamentals of doing the right thing, building the best products in the world, treating your customers as partners, that doesn't change. And abundance happens even in the worst of times. When you're fighting it, the universe just kind of sits back. The sales gods sit back and go, okay, I'll wait till you're done. You know, it's like when you have a child that's throwing a tantrum. Sometimes you just fold your hands and you go, are you done? You know, are you ready? And the same happens in business.
So that ability to constantly change and adapt depending on the environment, that typically comes from the culture within. Would you say that your business has a culture that's around that type of mindset?
Yeah, I think I was the last to join the parade. They were all in front of me. I was the one kicking and screaming, you know. And it's the hardest. I think the founder, the entrepreneur behind the business, is the hardest to convince. I used to take great pride that I thought I was the smartest person in the room, which is dangerous because I'm not that smart. And now I pride myself on being the stupidest person in the room, the least informed person in the room, because I think I'm pretty smart. And if I'm the lowest on the totem pole, I'm around a lot of smart people. So, you know, that's taking that ego, which is part of your first gear, and putting it on a shelf somewhere. You know, it's there, but I keep it buried as deep as I can. And that allows me to realize I don't know what I don't know. And that allows me to enter a situation with kind of a beginner's mindset, you know, like I had when I was much younger. And there were things that my team taught me. They would try and do something a certain way, and I would be like, ah, no, we did that. We did that 30 years ago. We did that 25 years ago. We did that 9 years ago. Yeah, that's, I thought that was a good for you. Good thought. I thought the same thing, but I was wrong. And then all of a sudden, they do it, and they do it, and it works. Like, oh man, I thought I knew everything. Yeah. So the more, my dad he was not much of a motivational speaker. He would have made a terrible motivational speaker. One of the things he liked to say is, "You learn your whole life, son, and you still die stupid." Like, is that should I put that on a Hallmark card? Is that one of those like Norman Vincent Peale motivational things?
Right.
But I think he was, in a way, in his own unique way, he was right. You know, the more you learn, the more you learn you don't know, how much you don't know. And so I think just leaving a space for openness and willingness to learn, particularly from younger people or newer people within your organization, is always be willing to change. Always. You know, you're a piece of clay. Just get molded. And mm-hmm. And that's hard for people like me. It may be hard for people like you. Anyone that's an entrepreneur that I've met, they still hold on to some of those first gear traits. And, you know, I still do. You know, I have to fight that all the time. And those are the things that they're little anchors. You know, they do slow you down. They add drag. And if we can get those out of the water or you know, trim our wings a little bit so we have less drag, we're going to fly smoother through the air or faster over the water. And those are things that many entrepreneurs just never quite learn, which is why 75% of all businesses still today are gone in 10 years. You know, it's hard to get out of I think founders are their own worst enemies in so many cases, 75% of the time.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. You know, if you're the person making a lot of the decisions, the choices, the smartest person, your company is only going to go so far before it hits that cap because you're only one person.
Yeah. I call it the small restaurant syndrome. You know, you have a restaurant with 10 tables and, you know, all of a sudden they fill up 10 tables, but they need 20 tables worth of revenue. They can't, you know, there's only 10 tables. They have maxed out their potential. And that's if the business grows, if the success of the business is solely reliant upon the entrepreneur's, the founder's skill set, then, I mean, maybe you have 10 tables, maybe you have 20 tables, but you don't have 1,000 tables. You don't have the ability to infinitely grow. And that, you know, I want my business to grow beyond me. You know, I'm just one person in this whole universe, right? It's capable of growing way beyond my skill set. And so, you know, my role in the last 30 years has been from working in my business to working on my business. They basically pay me to stay away. You know, I don't go to the office every day. I used to. I was just an integral part. You know, I used to sell machines by day and build them by night, you know, way back in the day, and load the forklift and you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, now I'm the, God help us, I'm the cheerleader of the company. I'm the public face of it. I give the lectures. I teach the webinars. I I speak at symposiums, and I, you know, I am the cheerleader for our industry, a very specific part of our industry, and that's what I do. I'm the guy in the crow's nest that tries to look over the horizon and shout down, you know, to the deckhands what I see. And it's the people on the deck of the boat that are running it. You know, they're the ones allowing machines orders to come in and machines to go out and customers to be happy and bills to be paid. And, you know, that they do that work that I used to do, not that well. And I get to do, there's my success. That's my success story right there. I get to do what I love to do and what I'm good at. I was never good at building machines. I was never good at running a company. Most entrepreneurs are not good at running a company. You know, Steve Jobs was terrible. He would be a terrible human resource manager, right? He'd get sued all the time, you know, right, for his, you know, fairly abusive behavior, but he was brilliant. The company would not have been the company without him. But, you know, eventually he learned his role. And when he came back after being fired by the board and he came back, he built that company up to way beyond what it was before and still going. And, and that's a good example of a company exceeding the capability of its founder, you know?
And honestly, that's a great example because one, he had to be knocked down, right? To understand that he had to put on a different hat. And then the other part is that they have a different type of leader running that company to this day that has a different set of gears and the type of gears that that company needs to run. So I think that's a great analogy and great way of looking at it.
Right. His Steve's ability, unique ability to charm the world and pitch his products and drive an industry to a direction that had never been driven. Was unique. And now they have a different requirement. Now they're a, you know, multinational manufacturer, and they're still going out into new areas, but slightly less risky and less controversial. And a little bit, you know, I can never call Apple mainstream, thankfully, but a little closer to mainstream than they were before. And that's where they are today. And that's exactly what was needed, whether Steve Jobs was alive today or not. That is exactly what was needed. And I would guess if he was still alive today, he would be playing a very different role than he was in the earlier years of Apple. He would be the guy giving the speeches and kissing the babies and, you know, giving his vision to the world. And not the guy
with like Bill Gates taking a, you know, step back from that company. And I think he saw probably the same thing. You know, I need to, this company is to go into a different direction and I'm not able to take it.
Right. Right. You know, even Lennon and McCartney wrote their best songs 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, not today. Well, clearly not with Lennon, but with McCartney. I mean, there's a time when you're very productive and you're very creative and that's where your work really makes an impact. And then there's a time when you're a caretaker and an inspiration to others, to the next generation of rebels. They're going to take over from where you left off. And knowing, you know, that's probably the overdrive gear, you know, knowing when to shift into that final gear and let the rest of the parts do the work. And I think that's key. That to me is success. Anyway, success is different to different people. For me, that's success. Watching my company thrive, not being part of the day to day, but being connected to it, is a joy.
That's great. So you talked about companies like Apple, who have had success, continued growth, continued success. And you've been in business for 30 years, seeing a ton of ups and downs in the industry and tons of changes, be it from, you know, financial crises, political crisis to regulations and all that sort of thing. And yet you found a way to stay relevant. And in this time, we've seen companies that were too big to fail, right? Companies like, you know, Toys R Us, Palm, Enron, Blockbuster, right?
Kodak. Yeah.
Kodak, yeah, that's another great example, who actually invented the digital camera and then never.
You're right. Yeah. And they have they still call them Kodak moments, and there's no Kodak anymore, at least not the way we think of Kodak. Yeah. I think those companies failed to adapt. You know, look at Blockbuster. Their main competition was Netflix. And, you know, they thought Netflix was just a little flimsy startup and they wouldn't last. And, you know, Blockbuster had probably, I don't know what percentage they had. They probably had a 60 or 70% of the market share. Hollywood Video was giving them a little run for the money back in those days. But, and then a whole bunch of tiny little family-owned video rental places. But they were the kings of the forest, and they kind of rested on their laurels and they waited a little too long. Kodak was threatened by their own invention. You know, they thought the digital camera, one half of them thought the digital camera was just a toy and no one's going to take it seriously. Oh, that's nice. You know, nice job. You know, here's your silver plated ashtray, and, you know, good job, invention of the year. And another side of them was scared and they wanted to bury it, you know? So, and no one believed that it would ever be threatened. But I'm sure the people who used to sell horseshoes didn't think the cars were going to be a threat until they were. Right? This happens all the time. It's revolution. We have two things in our industries, evolution and revolution. And every once in a while, we get revolution, which just is a game changer. And evolution is just survival of the fittest. But revolution changes everything. And I think these companies were probably victims of their own success. And they thought they were too big to fail. In our case, I started my business because specifically of government regulation. There was a particular cleaning solvent. We make cleaning machines for the electronics industry. And there was a cleaning solvent that was going to be banned by the EPA and actually by the US government and 11 other countries. Now all countries banned it. And they did a 10-year phase out. And it was such a popular chemical that no one thought the phase out would be real. You know, it would be like the EPA saying, hey, in 10 years, we're banning gasoline. Yeah, right. Yeah, let's see how that works out. Yeah. Well, they did ban it. And so we came up with an alternate method of cleaning boards, and it turned out to be successful. But so we started, our first day in business was this chemical going away. We got to come up with a solution. And so we're aware of government regulation. We're aware that things change. And some of the things that I thought were devastating to our company turned out to be the best things for our company, and only in hindsight. When the economic collapse happened, 2008, actually before that, when we got sued and we totally ran out of money, I couldn't afford to take a purchase order because I didn't have enough money to buy the parts or cover payroll. So we told customers that, you know, if you want to order a machine, you got to pay us half down. We took half the half and we paid the lawyer, and we took the other half of the half and we bought parts. And then when we shipped the machine and we eventually got paid, we took half the half and paid the lawyer and half the half and covered payroll and bought more parts. And who would put half down? And we're talking about $30,000 to $40,000 machines. Who would at the time give a brand new startup company money in advance before you even got a machine? No one said no. Nobody said no. They all said, okay, because there was no plan B.
Right.
If they said no, we go, okay, well, we understand. Yeah. Maybe next time. And there was no plan B. They would always come back and say, okay, fine, we're going to order the machine. But wait, but under protest, like, okay. But that was the only way we could have done it. There was no choice. I didn't have the guts to do it. There was just no choice. So thank God that we were put into a corner. And because till today, those are still our payment terms. Till today. And that's probably why we were able to survive some of the big financial crises that hit the world in our country. You know, the periodic recessions, the great recession, the pandemic. You know, one thing that after a certain time, one thing that we didn't have to worry about quite so much was cash flow. Now we do worry about cash flow every day. I still worry about cash flow every day. But we don't have a history of needing to worry about cash flow. Cash always came in when we didn't chase it. You ever see those optical illusions? It's just a bunch of vertical and horizontal lines. And between each line, you see a gray dot. But if you look at the gray dot, it's not there. It goes away. Mm-hmm. It's just there in your peripheral vision. That's money.
Yeah.
It's there. But if you stare at it, if you try and reach it, it's gone. It's not there. It's over here. Then you reach over here, and then it's over here. And to me, that's a seduction. That's a wild goose chase. You can chase money forever. Chase doing it right. Chase all the proper fundamentals. The money will come.
Absolutely. No, and I think about like what you're talking about with Kodak, right? And you're right. They invented the digital camera and then didn't pursue it because of fear. Now they're fear-based because how is this going to affect our film business?
Yeah.
Right? And it ended up destroying them. Whereas you have a company like Adobe, which I don't know if you remember, they used to charge a large amount for a software, right?
Yeah. They spent $2,500 for a piece of software. And then someone, I don't know what brave person in a boardroom said, I have an idea. Yep. Let's take this whole suite of $3,000 products and offer it for $79 a month. Mm-hmm. They would think that they would just ride that person out on the horse he came in on, right? That'd be crazy. But you're right, they did. And wild, I'm a creative suite. I'm one of their customers, you know. Yeah, sure. For $79 a month, I have $40,000 worth of Adobe products, right? Constantly updated. Who would have guessed that would have been successful?
Because then it went from a very niche market and then a whole ton of probably pirated software out there to now.
Well, Apple did the same thing. You know, Apple, you know, but back in the day of Napster and LimeWire, when, you know, these illegally peer-to-peer illegal music download sites, people were stealing music and the record companies would pick five poor people a year in the US and sue them, you know, to right. make them public examples. But the chance of getting sued was pretty low. And the reward was pretty high because record albums back then were, you know, $30 for an album, right? And you know, you had to kind of buy the whole album. You know, they didn't release every song as a 45. So young people are listening to this going, what the hell is he talking about? 45, 33 and a third. What is he talking about? But when Apple came out and said, look, you can buy any song for 99 cents, which was their original platform, that stopped the theft business. That stopped the illegal business. Because who's going to risk being that one in five Americans that are going to go to jail over a 99 cent song, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that was a scary move. They had to put fear on the table, right? Because they're trying to talk the record companies into, instead of a $30 album, let's just do a 99 cent single. And somehow they pulled it off. And no one steals music. I'm sure some do, but no one steals music anymore for the most part, you know, because you can just buy what you want for 99 cents. And it turns out they buy more. They buy more than the equivalent of a $30 album. I do. And now you don't even buy the music. Now you subscribe to it.
Right.
You know, for $10 a month, you can have all the 99 cent songs you want. You know, it's great value for the consumer. And it turned out to be great business move for the providers of that business. But yeah, the only way they could have done that was to take fear off the table. And I look back at all the decisions I've made over the years, and so many fear-based decisions. Every bad decision I've made, I can trace back to fear.
Yeah.
And when you're making fear-based decisions, you're making very short-term gain decisions, and one will pay the price. You know, for quick cash today, you're going to pay the price in a income statement loss at the end of the year, and then the banks are going to either cancel your credit line or charge you a higher rate of interest because you're not as favorable, and you're going to end up paying that back in spades. And if you can just take fear off the table a wise person told me, take time and money off the table and figure out what the right decision is. And if you had all the time in the world and all the money in the world, if this decision was obviously the right decision based on no correlation to time or money, then that's the right decision. Just do it. Money will come, which sounds very flippant if you're in the middle of a crisis, but it's true.
It's true.
Money will come.
And that's honestly, I think that fear-based decision-making is the killer of new businesses and the killer of the businesses that won't fail, right? There's a reoccurring theme behind that. And it's do what's right for your customers, you know, do what's right for the business. And you can't approach things from a place of fear. Really?
That's right. Yeah, it's very true. And it's so easy to say it. You know, it's easy for you and I to tell, you know, our audiences that, you know, just take fear off the table. Oh, okay. Yeah, oh, sure. No one told me that before. It's not, I probably heard that dozens of times before I heard it, before mm-hmm. I really heard it, before it sunk in. And it, I think the greatest benefit I can provide, or anyone that's talking to entrepreneurs, newer entrepreneurs, is it may not make sense now. It may sound crazy now, but just don't discard it. Just consider the possibility. Just put it on a shelf in your head. You can either throw it out, or you can embrace it, or you can consider it. And I had to learn to consider it. I'm one of these people that takes 10 seconds and I'm like, okay, that's out. That's good. That's out. That's good. It's this or this, you know, and not anything in the middle. And I had to learn how to consider the possibilities. I did not have that skill set. And I worked with someone to help me develop that. And that really, something doesn't make sense on Monday. By Friday, it starts to make sense. Once you just leave a space for it, mm-hmm. then it'll work its way in. And not everything, but what's right will work its way in. And if I just throw it out, if I discard it right away, again, sales God will go, okay, I'll wait till you're ready. Mm-hmm. You're not ready yet. And eventually it'll come around again. And, you know, maybe you're ready because there's no other choice.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Mike, and sharing your wisdom with us. Can you tell the audience how they get a hold of you?
Well, sure. Yeah. I always love to hear entrepreneur stories. I have a passion for that. I think I've ruined all my friends and my family's tolerance of me telling business stories. You know, it's like a war veteran. We like to tell stories about, you know, life in the foxholes, but no one else really cares. So if anyone wants to share their story with me or anything like that, or ask me any questions about my journey for whatever that might be worth, you can reach me at mike@mikeconrad.com. Just remember that's Conrad with a K. So mike@mikeconrad.com.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Mike.
Well, thanks, Phil. Thanks for inviting me on the show. I appreciate it. It's been a joy.
Take care. Well, thank you guys for watching today. Be sure to like and subscribe for more future episodes of Success Is Podcast. If you have any suggestions, please comment below. Look forward to seeing you next time.